From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we're going to the other side. Come along. Here's what's happening. Sad story to report tonight. World-renowned Egyptologist John Anthony West, a very frequent Coast to Coast guest, who spent the majority of his life fighting academia with his controversial theories of ancient Egypt, has died, according to a posting on his Facebook page. John was battling cancer for about a year plus. He will be missed. My gosh. Authorities say a woman was found holding her eyeball outside a South Carolina church. I'm not making this up. Anderson County Sheriff Chad McBride tells news outlets that it took two or three deputies and two emergency medical workers to subdue the woman to start rendering aid to her. A retired minister who helped the woman said it appeared that she had intentionally hurt herself. So, I don't know, did she pluck her eyeball out? That's a horrible story. Russian cyber spies pursuing the secrets of military drones and other sensitive U.S. defense technology tricked key contract workers into exposing their email to theft. Hackers. Lauren Weinstein, expert on the internet, with us. How serious is this story, Lauren?
Yeah, this could be very serious, but it's mostly serious for what it tells us about how people aren't protecting their email accounts. Apparently, this was done. This was mostly an attack on Gmail. It was mostly an attack on people's personal Gmail accounts. And you're not supposed to have secret information on there, of course, but it's people are kind of sloppy sometimes. And of course, this is good. It's good for if you're trying to recruit spies, you get blackmail, leverage, things like that by reading that kind of email. The thing that's so important here is that this was done through phishing. The usual way you get these messages that look like they're from your bank, or they claim your account's being closed. You click the link in there, you enter your credentials, and the bad guys have a way in. Any account you have, whether it's Google or anywhere else, if it's just a username and a password, it's vulnerable. It is so crucial to use the two-step, two-factor logins that are available. Google recently reported that less than 1 in 10 Gmail users actually have that enabled, even though it's relatively easy to set up. So I have a challenge for listeners tonight.
Do it.
If you have Gmail or you have other services on Google that you use and you don't have two-step enabled right now, I urge you to set it up tonight. I've put a link to Google's two-step verification. It's right there in the middle of my vortex.com homepage, vortex.com.
Okay.
It'll take you directly to the Google pages for this. It would be so cool if tomorrow morning the account team up at Google Mountain View looked at their system dashboards and said, hey, where did this bump in two-step activations come from? But more importantly, you'd be safer, so I really urge everyone to give it a try.
Super. Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate everything you do for us. The tumble in cryptocurrencies that erased nearly $500 billion of market value over the past month could get a lot worse, according to Goldman Sachs Group's global head of investment research. Most digital currencies are unlikely to survive in their current form, and investors should prepare for coins to lose all of their value as they're replaced by a small set of future competitors. So listen to that. Maybe we're still going to do our coast-to-coast coin, huh? Or something like that. You never know. U.S. stocks ran out of steam on Wednesday in a sign that investors are still spooked by the market's recent retreat, and they're very wary of more fallout that will probably come. Investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, I have a feeling this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, George, we're you know, don't you get sick of me saying this?
No.
We
love you.
We're over 3 years overdue for a 10 to 20% correction, which would be very healthy, normal, and natural. You know, we've all got to, because it's been up, up, up for 5 years straight, I call it the stairway of heaven. It goes up a little bit every day forever. You know, and that's what we all want, of course. But, you know, markets don't work like that. They go up and down. So, you know, if we got a 10 to 20% correction, it'd be perfectly natural and healthy. Not to say that if you look at what's going on in the world, that, you know, if somebody's stupid enough to start a war, we can mess up a good bull market. But this is a correction. We have not yet given up all our gains in the, you know, we basically given up our gains that we got in this year. We're still up over, you know, 3% for the last 3 months on the S&P. So I think we need to keep this in perspective.
I think we have too, but I just have a feeling that anything that goes on this planet is going to create a massive downturn in the stock market.
Well, here's the thing. We have three very deflationary pressures happening. One is the Fed is trying to clean up their massively inflated balance sheet, and around the world we see central banks trying to get back. That's number one. Number two, we see tech moving in and deflating all sorts of industries. So, you know, we saw groceries get Amazon last year, but now we're watching healthcare get Amazon. And, you know, that's a healthy thing. It's going to happen. And, for example, if you look at healthcare stocks, they've gotten clocked, but they've gotten clocked because, you know, they're pumped by things which are bad for the consumer. It's time for that industry to get reengineered. But finally, if you look at how aggressive this administration has been in, has been on military expenditure, what they're saying about military expenditure, demanding provisions that they don't have to report the black budget to the House and Senate Select Committee. Now you're talking about the black budget being completely out of control. And now, you know, $1.5 trillion for a nuclear arsenal and reserving the right to do first strike. I mean, you're talking about putting pressure on the bond market, which, of course, is sending yields up. And if you look at what's been going on in the Treasury market or REITs, interest rates up. So war, you know, war is the ultimate deflation. What
there's no question about that. And what do you think of the Bitcoin collapse right now?
Well, here's the thing. You know, we the central banks have benefited tremendously from a period of experimentation with cryptocurrencies, because if you're trying to accumulate gold and keep the gold price down while you accumulate, what could be more wonderful than all the money getting sucked into Bitcoin? So, you know, gold has worked for the powers that be, but now that the prototyping period is over, you're starting to see the regulators getting ready to step in. CPAs are sending little messages to their clients saying, we want to see a complete copy of your ledger of all your trading for your 2017 taxes. That's putting a chill throughout the market. And we see the UK come out with a gold-backed cryptocurrency from the UK Mint, the Royal Mint. So, I mean, here's the thing. Which would you rather have, a UK Royal Mint cryptocurrency or something that's got nothing behind it?
Well, you know what? I wouldn't want anything from the Federal Reserve. Thanks, Catherine. Take care. Republican and Democratic Senate leaders have announced a budget agreement that includes a big boost in spending for the Pentagon and would keep the government running past a looming deadline. Now, Congress has just a few more days to pass a spending bill. Let's see what they do there. Up next, of course, we're going to be talking about incredible things going on in space. That very successful SpaceX launch of the Falcon Heavy booster that occurred yesterday. It was amazing. Robert Zubrin with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, one of my favorite people with us, Robert Zubrin. Robert was with me, by the way, in Boulder, Colorado last month, taping a Beyond Belief episode. He did a great job. Robert is the president of Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Robert has studied and researched in the fields of aerospace and energy. He has a PhD in nuclear engineering as well. Robert Zubrin back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Robert.
Hello, George. Thanks for having me back.
I'm looking forward to this. And what great timing to have you on, Robert, because yesterday's Falcon Heavy launch was just spectacular. What did you think of that?
It's a revolution. It's tremendous. I mean, in order to get a sense of this, okay, people should remember, in 2009, President Obama put together a Blue Ribbon Commission headed by Norm Augustine, the former CEO of Lockheed Martin, to evaluate the possibility of carrying out this moon program that Bush had started. And they came to the conclusion that it was impossible, fiscally impossible, because according to them, all these wise men, it would take at least 12 years and $36 billion to develop a heavy lift launch vehicle, and that was off the chart. And so they canceled the program. Now, here's Elon Musk. They did this, SpaceX, in 6 years, half the time.
Unbelievable.
In less than $1 billion, okay? That is less than a 30th of the money, half the time, a 30th of the money, and not only that, the system is three quarters reusable. Okay, so this is off the chart. The naysayers have been completely refuted and discredited here. And And by the way, Musk went to the Augustine Commission and he testified and he said, look, I'd be happy to develop a heavy lift vehicle for you for $2.5 billion. They laughed him out of the room. He ended up doing it for less than one. And so this shows, you know, what the private initiative can do. And of course, it's not just Musk. It's this whole terrific team at SpaceX. These people are raring to go.
Brilliant people.
Yeah. You know, one person said to me online, well, you know, this isn't the second coming of the Saturn V. I said, no, it's better than that. It's the second coming of the rocket team. The rocket team was Wernher von Braun's team, which were the people.
This is a new team altogether, isn't it?
It's a new team. But I got to tell you something. They didn't, I mean, they showed they could do it, yes, but they showed something more. They showed that it can be done. And so, because until SpaceX, all the stuff about private space launch companies was mostly bunk, okay? It was just nonsense.
Well, it was, you know, as we used to say, mummy foo-foo. It was up in the clouds. Nobody believed it.
Right. But now it can happen. So there's going to be more SpaceXs. Okay, I mean, there already is another one coming up behind him, which is the Blue Origin, with funding from Jeff Bezos. But beyond that, there's going to be still more. I'm certain there's going to be a Russian SpaceX, and there'll be a Chinese SpaceX.
I think so, too.
And by a SpaceX, I don't mean a branch of Musk SpaceX. I mean another company like SpaceX, a competitor.
But will Russia and China allow private companies to do this, or will they try to control it?
They're going to have to. They're going to do it kicking and screaming for the same reason that these tyrannies in the past had to allow universal literacy in their countries, because if they didn't, they would never be able to compete militarily with the advanced countries. Okay, they're going to have to allow private enterprise, or they're going to be left in the dust. Space capabilities today are core technologies for national defense. I mean, the ability to control near-Earth space with reconnaissance satellites, communication satellites, and GPS satellites. If one military has it and the other doesn't, if you're talking about a large-scale conventional war, it's an overwhelming advantage. I mean, if you think for a minute, you know, how World War II would have gone if, say, the Axis powers had had reconnaissance satellites.
Oh, my gosh.
The Japanese would have been able to see our fleet at Midway long before we knew where they were. They would have sunk.
Or if the Nazis had developed the atomic bomb before we did.
Yeah, but that's obvious. The atomic bombs, of course, are a crushing weapon. But I'm just pointing out that even reconnaissance satellites, which people don't think that much about, okay, in the same way as they think about things like atomic bombs, it would be decisive in a major war. So, in other words, Putin is going to have to shape up, okay, because there are people in Russia. They've got the technical talent. There are pools of capital there that are held by people who believe it's important to expand into space, but they're not going to create their own SpaceX if they think that Putin can just take it away from them.
Well, let me ask you, Robert, though, do you think the Russians and the Chinese need a SpaceX-type company, or are they doing well on their own right now?
They're going to need one because a new standard has been set.
Okay.
And that's really, you know, Musk has raised the bar here on the level of accomplishment. Yeah, if these guys were just competing with NASA and Lockheed Martin and the kind of slowboat space program we've had here for a while, they could get by with what they've got. But they can't get by with what they've got if they're competing against stuff like SpaceX.
Why couldn't NASA do what SpaceX is doing now? That's what I can't get. Was it bogged down in government malarkey or what?
Well, there's a couple of things. Now, I would point out that at one point in its history, NASA did do stuff like this. Okay.
Yes, they did. Yes, there's no question about it.
That's why I said this is the second coming of the rocket team. Okay, they were mission driven. They were completely committed to get to the moon by the end of the decade, and The kind of people who were in NASA then, they were young, they were willing to work through the night and through the weekend and do whatever it took. And furthermore, they didn't have departments sitting there spinning out regulations to make the other department impossible to accomplish its job, okay, which is what you've got in NASA right now. In other words, you've got these people trying to design a rocket and these people setting requirements who don't really care whether it's possible to meet those requirements, and so they put an impossible job on the other one. And it's totally bizarre, okay? And look, NASA has basically created regulations for itself that would prevent it from landing people on Mars.
How so? What did they do?
For fear of contaminating Mars with
with microbes from Earth or something?
Precisely. And so, you know, unless they shut down the so-called Planetary Protection Department, you can't send humans to Mars. So they're spending all these billions of dollars supposedly to get ready to send humans to Mars while they actually have created regulations for themselves that would make it impossible for them to go to Mars.
Crazy.
And which, by the way, are already impairing the operations of the Curiosity rover on Mars. There were places that they wanted to send Curiosity where it seemed like there might be some water at the surface of Mars, which would be the most interesting place to go, and they said, you can't go there. So here we spend billions of dollars on this rover, and we can't send it to the most interesting places because we've got this bureaucracy. But coming back to this subject here, there's another factor, which is NASA has been doing business through its contractors with a method of contracting called cost plus, which means they say, well, we don't want you to cheat us, so you can charge us whatever it cost you plus 8%.
Plus a percent. Instead of a zillion dollars for a ratchet or something like that.
Yeah, but this is what makes it cost a zillion dollars for the ratchet. Because, you see, if instead the contractor came to you and said, look, I'll deliver you a fighter aircraft for $1 million, and you don't look at my books, so you don't look at how much it cost me to build it. It's $1 million fair price, right? You'll get your plane for $1 million.
That's right.
Okay, instead they say, we'll give you whatever it costs plus 10%. Well, in that case, the contractor says, well, okay.
The higher, the better.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'd rather get my 8% on $10 zillion than $1 million.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And so they create enormous overhead structures within these companies. And the longer it takes and the more it costs, the more money they make. And so they reverse the incentives. Now, with SpaceX, it's the right way because he does most of his business with fixed price contracts and saying, look, you know, I'll give you good value. Don't bother me about how much it costs me. And then he's working like a demon to drive his own costs down.
I mean, who is physically, for example, building the heavy booster? Who built it?
SpaceX.
I mean,
in their factory.
They've got their own factory. Okay.
Oh, yes, they have their own factory. And not only that, you know, Musk was unwilling to pay gold-plated prices for subcomponents like engines and avionics systems. So he developed all those himself. The company is totally vertical.
Amazing.
In other words, they subcontract very little. They build their own engines instead of buying engines from someone. I mean, Lockheed Martin boosters, they're buying their engines from Russia.
Wow.
Which, by the way, is a national security concern.
Yeah, that sure is. Now, is Musk doing this to make money, or is it ego?
I think, and I actually know Musk.
You know him. You're the one who tried to convince him to send humans to Mars, aren't you?
Well, I had a role in it, yes.
We'll talk about that next half hour, but go ahead.
Yeah, he read my book.
Is it ego or trying to make
it's
money?
It's not exactly ego. Okay, it's what the ancient Greeks called kleos, which is eternal glory for doing great deeds. So what Musk is about, okay, is he's not into cheap fame like Paris Hilton fame, okay, and he's not into doing good deeds just to do good deeds, okay? He wants to get eternal glory for doing great deeds. That's my reading on Musk. And so, you know, he's not a saint, But he's not a greedy, egotistical person. He wants to make his mark. His goal, in a sense, is immortality, not in terms of actually living forever or in any mystical sense.
He wants his name on that tombstone, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, he wants, Thomas Edison, 1880, invented the light bulb. Who was Secretary of State?
Who knows?
Right. Exactly.
Who cares?
Who cares? You know, who was the biggest star on Broadway? Who was, no one knows, but we know Edison.
That's right. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to come back and talk about going to Mars in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, lots of events coming up. First of all, next Tuesday, it's not too late. Come on by our very first luncheon series of the year with Dr. Sky. We're going to talk about space. I'll be out there. Producer Tom will be out there, too. It'll be in Los Angeles. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com and include your phone number. They'll call you and set it up for you, and you'll come out to the luncheon and have, hopefully, a great time. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Now, the three major events that are coming up over the next couple months: Salt Lake City, Utah; Scottsdale, Arizona; and Las Vegas, Nevada. March 10th, Salt Lake City event. April 21st is the Scottsdale event. June 9th at the Silverton Casino is the Las Vegas event. Get your tickets early, folks. Now, in terms of Salt Lake City, Tommy says there are 70 key seats left that he really wants to move. So all you need to do for all three of these events, wherever you may be, go to coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, click Events, and then you'll see all these events, and you can click them, and they'll take you to their respective websites, and you can order your tickets right there. You can see your seats in most of these cases and pick where you want to throw things at me. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Robert Zubrin with us. His website, MarsSociety.org, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. And we will take calls next hour with Robert Zubrin as we talk about space. Robert, let's talk a little bit about Mars. But you did talk to Elon Musk about getting human to Mars. Tell me about that conversation.
Oh, well, this was back in 2001. And the Mars Society held a fundraising dinner in the Bay Area, and it was $500 a plate. And we got this check from somebody, and it was $5,000.
A little, maybe somebody wanted 10 chairs, right?
Well, he didn't. He just wanted two. But he wanted, to get a little attention, and he got it. And so who's this Elon Musk? Had never heard of him. So we looked him up and found out that, oh, he was the head of PayPal. So, okay, so he's loaded, right?
And he's loaded.
And we had heard of PayPal, although it was a bit new at that time because there were some people annoying us by wanting to pay us with PayPal instead of with checks or credit cards like normal.
And you're probably saying, what is this PayPal? What is this?
Okay, yeah, but anyway, so I made sure to have a long cup of coffee with him, an hour-long cup of coffee with him before the event. And then afterwards, he came out here to Denver to my company, Pioneer Astronautics, and he donated $100,000, and he joined the board of the Mars Society. And for a while, we were talking about him funding us doing launching an experiment into Earth orbit, which would contain some mice in a rotating capsule that would give them artificial gravity, and not just artificial gravity, but artificial gravity at Mars levels. So we would see how mammals from Earth would fare in Mars gravity, both those born and raised on Earth and also their children born and raised on Mars. But after a while, he said to me, look, I'm not the kind of guy that wants to be part of someone else's operation. I got to do my own thing, And I could do something much more productive on my own than just, being a member of the Mars Society team or anything like that. And so he went off and started SpaceX. But, well, actually, let me get back. When he left the board of the Mars Society, we had a conversation. And he said, look, I've made all the money that I could ever want. And now it's a question for me, what am I going to do with my life that's really going to matter? Okay. And he couldn't decide between two things. And one was Mars, And we had talked a lot about Mars, and he read the book, The Case for Mars, and he understood that Mars is really important, making humanity a spacefaring species. And the other was solar energy. Okay, he thought that that would be the major breakthrough to take place in our time to get us off of fossil fuels and onto solar power. And it was going to be one or the other. And I argued forcefully for Mars and for space because I said to him, Elon, look, you know, the commercial applications of solar power are obvious. If anyone has a credible plan for a new technology or a new way of doing business with it, they can find investors, and if the thing can actually become competitive against fossil fuels, it will spread and it will become universally accepted, and if it can't, then it won't. Okay, but on the other hand, you can't go to, you know, Wall Street with a business plan to set up a colony on Mars. They'll laugh you out of there. And so to open up the space frontier is going to take someone with vision. And in other words, the solar energy will either happen or not, and it doesn't need Elon Musk to make it happen, okay? But Mars, maybe not. And so in the end, he decided to do both, and of course, as we know, he created a car company too, an electric car company, Tesla. But that's what that was. In other words, I basically made the point that this was not going to happen without him. And
You were right about that.
Yeah. Now, I do want to talk a bit about this Falcon Heavy itself, okay, because we have now been given a tool, okay? I mean, there's...
This can get us to Mars, can it?
It can, and the moon. Now, some people say it can't because, okay, let's talk about what it is and what it isn't. It's, the Atlas can lift 20 tons to Earth orbit. It costs $200 million a launch. The Delta IV Heavy, which is the heaviest launcher in current operation until the Falcon Heavy, 30 tons to orbit, but $300 million a launch. Now, here comes Musk with the Falcon Heavy, 60 tons to orbit, that is twice as much as the Delta, and $100 million a launch, one-third the cost. Twice the payload, one-third the cost. Six times the value per price. Okay, one-sixth the cost per kilogram to orbit, okay, of its competitors. So this is a major breakthrough. Yet, still, it's only 60 tons. The Saturn V we had during Apollo was 120, okay? So the Falcon Heavy is kind of a semi-heavy compared to the Saturn V, okay? It's tougher than all the other kids on the block, but there was one that used to be here that was bigger, okay? But nevertheless, we can do a moon mission. We can build a moon base with the Falcon Heavies, because if you can lift 60 tons to Earth orbit, you can land 12 tons on the moon, which is enough. Okay, it's enough to build a moon base in modular style.
Sure.
Landing a HAB, landing a power system, then sending the astronauts. Okay, we could do this. And by the way, let me just say, if it was up to me, where I would put the base would be near the moon's south pole, because there's high elevation terrain there that's always in sunlight, and nearby there's craters that are always in darkness. So you'd put the base in the sunlit place, and you'd put your power system there, so it would always have sun and power, and in the crater, which is always in dark, that's where water has condensed and frozen, and we can actually beam power from the base into that crater to power mining operations, to mine that ice and bring it out, and then we can turn it into rocket fuel and not just use it to come back to Earth with, though we would do that, but also to power rocket hoppers that could fly around the moon, sailing forth from the base, so they wouldn't be confined to this base at the South Pole. They'd be able to visit most of the moon using rocket flight vehicles. So we could do a moon base with Falcon Heavies. Okay, we could do...
Now, how far does the Falcon take you? Because if it's reusable, how do you get it back if it's way out into space like that?
Okay, well, the Falcon Heavy is not entirely reusable. It's three-quarters reusable. That is, there's three booster stages, and then there's an upper stage on top of them.
Okay.
Okay. Now, right now, it's the three booster stages which are reusable. It's really more than three quarters reusable because the booster stages are bigger than the upper stage. So it's not just that there's three of them and one of the other. The three are bigger. And so it's more important to, you know, each of them have nine engines. The upper stage only has one engine. So really, maybe it's 90% reusable.
Boy, their memory technology on those boosters must be amazing.
Yeah. And what happened yesterday was they successfully landed the two side boosters right back at the Cape Canaveral launch site. And you may have seen the video of that.
It was spectacular. It really
They're coming down together like, boom, you know, like a dance. And then the third one, the center, keeps going after those two separate. And they tried to land that on the drone ship downrange out at sea, but they did have a malfunction and it landed in the water instead. But they'll get that right the next time. Okay, so they can reuse the three boosters with between them 27 engines. Okay, and it's just the one engine on the uppermost stage that they're not getting back. And that is the one that fired that Tesla off on a Transmars trajectory. So it's actually going on Transmars trajectory too. So they didn't just send the Tesla not actually to Mars, but to Mars orbit, that is to the orbit of Mars and beyond it a bit, but also the
Are we going to get beaten to Mars with a person, with a man or a woman, of course?
Well, depends who you mean by we. Do I think NASA is going to get beaten? I think
they already have been.
Okay. Well, no. I mean, NASA is still the main people.
You think NASA is still ahead of Russia and China in terms of space technology?
With respect to Mars, yes, they are. NASA's had, I don't know the exact number, that I think it's about 18 successful robotic Mars missions. The Europeans have had two, and the Russians none. And
good point.
One.
And China nothing.
Yeah. So NASA is still ahead, but in terms of robotic Mars missions, but in terms of getting humans to Mars, they don't really seem to want to do it. They're always coming up with excuses. You know, it's like the snow day, you know? You get 3 inches of snow, and you got a 10-year-old kid, and he's there saying, oh, it's much too dangerous to go to school today. Look at all that snow. There needs to be a snow day, you know? And you can argue like a lawyer that the school should be shut, and even if it's not shut, you don't want to make me go because, you know,
Chances are the school will shut it down anyway, though.
Right, but you know what I'm saying? That NASA, in other words, hype the data showing the radiation hazard, which is really quite modest compared to the other elements of mission risk. Or they'll say we can't go to Mars until we have giant interplanetary spaceships that have ion drives, or until we have a moon base or a base orbiting the moon, or until we retrieve an asteroid from interplanetary space and put it in orbit around. And they'll come up with anything. Whereas Musk is not looking for excuses to not go to Mars. He's looking to get to Mars. And, you know, if we had been looking for excuses not to get to the moon in the 1960s, we definitely could have found a way not to get to the moon in the 1960s. But NASA then wasn't looking for excuses, and Musk isn't looking for excuses now.
Where does Bigelow fit into all this, Robert?
Well, Bigelow is developing inflatable space habitations.
Hotels.
And they are interesting because in this connection, they're interesting in general, but they're interesting in this connection because, see, the Falcon Heavy doesn't have that large a fairing, a cargo envelope on top. So if you wanted to send a crew to Mars with a Falcon Heavy, it'd be hard to put on top of it the complete habitation module to live in on the way to Mars,
mm-hmm.
But you could put a Bigelow module in there and inflate it after it's on its way, and then you'd have a big house to live in on your way to Mars.
Hoping nothing hits it.
Well, they're pretty well armored against micrometeorites.
Are they?
Stuff.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, no. In fact, probably more than they should be. They're making them heavier, in my view as an engineer, but certainly not less than they should be. No, those things are fine.
You wrote a book called The Case for Mars, The Plan to Settle the Red Planet, Why We Must. So the big question is, why do we need to go to Mars? I'm going to be a devil's advocate here for a moment.
Okay. you know, the devil has a lot of advocates already, George.
Yes, I know. You don't need one more.
But anyway, there's three reasons. I mean, the reasons NASA will tell you, and there is for the science to find out if we are alone in the universe or if life evolved on other planets. Okay, that's a valid reason. There's the challenge that it would do for our society. It would encourage millions of young people to go into science, and that would benefit us enormously.
As the moon landings did. I mean, we all wanted to be astronauts in those days, remember?
Yes, and very few of us ended up being astronauts, but an awful lot of us ended up being scientists and engineers and inventors and technological entrepreneurs and doctors and medical researchers. And that bunch, Apollo's children, and I was one of them, you know, we've contributed a great deal to advanced science and technology and medicine and all the things that advance human life. So we got paid back very heavily for Apollo with the intellectual capital it encouraged. But the most important thing, you see, is really for the future. Okay? I mean, look, you ask any American what happened in 1492. And they'll tell you, well, in 1492, Columbus sailed. And that, of course, is true. But that's not the only thing that happened in 1492. In 1492, England and France signed a peace treaty. In 1492, the Borgias took over the papacy. In 1492, Lorenzo de' Medici, the richest man in the world, died. If there had been newspapers in 1492, those would have been the headline events. But we don't remember them. What we remember is Columbus. Okay? Now, if we do what we can do in our time, which is establish that first little Plymouth Rock settlement on Mars, then 500 years from now, there will be new branches of human civilization on Mars, and not just on Mars, but on every planetary body that can be settled in this solar system, and on thousands of planets orbiting thousands of stars in nearby interstellar space. And the people of that grand civilization, when they look back at this time, what will they consider as important? Will they consider important which gang of thugs came out on top in Syria, or who was in or who was out in Washington, and this and that and the other thing? No, they won't even know about those things. But what we did to make their grand civilization possible, that will be important. And so this is the most important thing
happening
in the world today.
If we can survive that, Robert, do you think we can? Do you think we can get 500 more years out of this civilization?
Yes, if we decide to grow. It's a question of grow or die. But yes, if we decide to grow, if we take this opportunity that Elon Musk has now set before us, where he's saying, look, you want to open the space frontier? Here's the rocket. Let's do it. Well, let's do it, and let's become a multi-planet species, and let's have thousands of worlds and thousands of new cultures and civilizations making all sorts of contributions to everything from technology to literature and, you know, setting examples of heroic deeds to those who will even push out further. Yes, we can. We're not living at the end of history. We're living at the beginning of history.
It's remarkable times to be alive, too. What about spending so much time in zero gravity?
Well, you don't have to. Okay, well, first of all, if you're going to the moon, it's 3 days. It's no big deal.
That's no big
deal. If you're going to Mars, it's 6 months. Well, you can do that in zero gravity. That's the typical rotation on the space station. But it does weaken you. However, we don't have to go in zero gravity. If we rotate the spacecraft, okay, and for instance, one way to do it is you have the upper stage of the booster that sent you on your way to Mars. It's now empty, but it's still a good counterweight. You have your habitation module that you're living in. You separate the two, stretching a tether between them, and then you rotate it around, creating centrifugal force. You create artificial gravity in the habitat, and so you don't decondition the crew.
Interesting. Robert, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're at the top of the hour already, but we're going to come back and talk more with you. I want to talk about your interstellar communication paper that you wrote, and also we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.